You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. We will be talking nothing but draft when we talk Atlanta Braves. Looking at the draft and also the starting rotation and the scuffling outfield of the Miami Marlins. Talking Mets draft and taking a look at that six-man rotation that was a six-man rotation for a couple of days. We're talking draft and trade rumors when we talk Philadelphia Phillies. When we talk Nationals, we'll be looking at that draft and also taking a look at the Ryan Zimmerman situation. Well, the Nats did not have a first-round pick for a pretty good reason, but sometimes that can affect the way a team approaches their first few picks. They can either want to make sure they get a safe pick or they can want to make sure they get a high upside pick. It can have an impact. Do you think that not having a first-round pick affected how the Nats approach their first few picks?
Not at all. I don't think so, because the way it was told to me by Chris Klein, for example, he said, we already have our first-round pick by getting Max Scherzer. So they lost their first-round pick by that. But then they picked up a future leadoff hitter in Andrew Stevenson, and they really think he can be a top-of-the-order guy who can steal bases. He's a great outfielder defensively, and apparently he's going to be an impact bat, apparently. They really believe that. He has an unorthodox swing, but they plan to make adjustments on that. So, and I spoke to Andrew Stevenson today, in fact, and he says he's willing to do anything to be successful. So that's about it.
Yeah, you kind of led into my next question. What exactly do they think they have in Stevenson?
Well, they think he's going to be a future leadoff hitter. They says, you know, they refuse to say he's like Eric Burns, but he plays like Eric Burns because he plays as if he has hair on, you know, his hair is on fire. He really works hard, and he's always hustling, and he's always willing to do anything to help the team win. So I think they have a really good player in that guy.
Do they think he has the potential to be a fast riser in the system?
Yes, that's, you know, a guy like that, yes, they do. There's no question about it. And he is, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he started at Hagerstown, and then he'll rise quickly and hopefully become their leadoff hitter.
They started with three straight outfielders. Was that a coincidence or was that by design?
That was by design because they lack what they call top-of-the-order type hitters, guys who are fast. So it was by design. And then if you saw the rest of the draft, they picked almost nothing with pitchers. So as Chris Klein always tells me this all the time, you never have enough and pitching. And pitching wins championships. He's always telling me that. So that's what happens.
The other thing that you noted was that it was a very college-heavy draft. Again,
correct.
Same question. Is that by coincidence? Were those just the players that happened to be available that they liked at their pick? Or again, was that by design?
It's by design because, as Chris Klein told me, with college players, you know what you're going to get. And, you know, it's easy to predict the type of players they will become. They feel it's hard when you draft a high school player. That's hard to predict, they feel. So I'm not surprised they picked nothing but college players. They've been doing this, really, since Rizzo has been the GM. So that's his goal. I mean, his goal is to get almost nothing but college players. And, you know, you've seen it with Rendon, Harper, Strasburg, all came from college. So they know what those guys are going to be like.
To switch to the 2015 Nationals, the big news most recently is now that Ryan Zimmerman is out. First of all, what kind of time frame are they looking at? I mean, obviously plantar fasciitis is a pretty significant injury.
Well, talking to some of the people I talked to yesterday, it seems that Ryan will not be on the disabled list that long, hopefully. But we have to wait and see. He's been playing with it almost all year long, really, and he couldn't take the pain anymore. So that's why he wanted the DL. And if you notice, he didn't play against the Yankees that much. So that was the reason. And hopefully he won't be out long. And we'll see Tyler Moore and Clint Robinson at first base. And hopefully they can be productive.
obviously, if they're not expecting a long term, then this is not going to be surgery, at least now. Is this just a let it quiet down kind of thing? I know there's a procedure similar to ultrasound that Albert Pujols had. What's the plan to attack this to make it so that he can be ready to go when he comes back?
Well, it's kind of like let it quiet down right now. He was in Baltimore yesterday. I don't know the results of that. He was in Baltimore to see the foot doctor. So right now, the way Matt Williams told the story, they're gonna let the foot quiet down a little bit, and then you know they'll just hopefully things will get better. But if you want to know why Ryan Zimmerman's having a bad year, it's because of that.
Well, that was my next question. Do they think that this is the explanation for why his numbers are down so much?
There's no doubt about it because, you know, I'll be honest with you. He could I tell you, when I watched him, and I said this like in April, I thought Ryan Zimmerman looked done. I'm being honest with you. And, like, people thought, you're crazy. He'll come back. But he was injured. So, you know, hopefully this will quiet it down. Ryan Zimmerman's not a 213 hitter. He's a great hitter, and I'm expecting him to come back full blazes when he's healthy.
What will they do at first base in the interim?
I think it's going to be Clint Robinson and Tyler Moore. Those guys have the experience at first base. I just think that they'll platoon there, and hopefully they can be productive. You just never know. I mean, it's hard to predict because – Tyler Moore hasn't had a good year since really 2012. This is Clint Robinson's first year in the major leagues, really, full season. And so far, he's been pretty good hitting-wise, coming off the bench. So, again, it's a wait and see. It's hard to predict. You hope they can come through in the clutch.
Is there any pressure or need or anything to look at a bat from the outside, not so much explicitly because Zimmerman is out, but the being down him and Worth, and as you note, the fact that Moore, who's a guy I like, just still has not put it together. Do they start looking at bringing in some kind of bat from the outside?
You know, Matthew, I'm going to take this to another level. I think this team needs to make changes. I think, they need to make changes because this team looks dead. And, you know, you have a couple of guys who are free agents. I think you got to trade them. I think you got to trade the Ian Desmonds. I love him. He's like my son. I think you got to trade the Ian Desmonds, the Jordan Zimmermans of the world, because I think it's obvious to me there's a distraction going on right now. And I think something has to be done. This team is not playing up to its capabilities right now. And I think moves have got to be made. I don't know what you do, get another hitter, get another pitcher, but you got to do something because it looks dead right now.
So you don't think this is as simple as the fact that they're down two starting pitchers and some key
hitters? No, they're dead. They look dead, man. I mean, they look dead. They look dead. I mean, Anthony Rendon is back. It doesn't matter. They look dead to me, man. It doesn't matter that Jason Worth is out. I mean, they just need to make changes, man. They do.
Well, one thing that could help would be to get some starting pitchers back. Can you give us an update on Doug Fister and Steven Strasburg, where those guys are at?
Well, Fister needs another start before we see him back. Yes, he gave up three runs, and, you know, as the people in Syracuse tweeted, he didn't look as bad as the numbers indicated. So I'm assuming he's going to get one more start before he comes back. Strasburg, I don't know what's going to happen to him. I know he's with the team right now, but, you know, he's trying to figure out, again, what's wrong with his pitching. I mean, yes, he has the neck problems, but it's more than that. He has to figure out mechanics and other things. So I really don't know.
The Mets did not have a first-round pick this year. First of all, just kind of broadly, how did that affect their approach, their strategy as they went through the early rounds of the draft?
I mean, it didn't affect it that much other than the guys who you know without a shadow of a doubt are going in the top 10, 15, 20. You don't really have to bother scouting those guys. But beyond that, I don't think it really affected what they did. The guy they took in the first round is a guy they had their eye on as one of probably, you know, I would guess probably about 5 or 10 guys they liked and, you know, in that spot. And you can sort of target in a sense. But when you get to the second round and the third round and beyond, it's hard to really say for sure what's going to be there, what's going to be available, because teams' draft boards can tend to be wildly different than their own. But, you know, the Mets like what they did. They added in the draft in general. They added quite a few pitchers. About 3/4 of their picks were pitchers. But they also took some big bats at the beginning, including their first-round pick, or their second-round pick, Desmond Lindsay, an outfielder who they like a lot. So, you know, it was, well, obviously they would have liked to have had a first-round pick. That was a calculated risk that they took at the time when they decided to sign Michael Kadire and forfeit it. They thought Michael Kadire was worth it. And if last night's walk-off home run was any indication, and if the past month for Kadire, when he's really been rounding into form, was any indication, I think they're starting to see some dividends on that investment.
The first round, the first pick, I should say, Desmond Lindsay, fell a bit, evidently due to health. First of all, are there any concerns about his health going forward, or is it just the fact that people didn't get to see him that much, and so it's hard to jump too much on a guy you didn't get to see play as much?
Yeah, I don't think the Mets would have taken if they had any serious concerns about his health. And, you know, you look at the guy who his opinions on him tend to be all over the place. He was not in MLB.com's top 200 draft prospects going in. He was not in Baseball America's top 100, but some other publications, Baseball Prospectus, for example, had him pretty high. So it's clear that this is a guy with a lot of tools. He's got power. He's got speed. Will that translate? It's tough to say. It's always tough to say when you get these high school guys. The Mets have had sort of mixed success. They've taken guys similar to him high in the draft, and by that I mean high school guys without necessarily big track records, guys who are considered riskier picks. You know, famously, Sandy Ellison's first pick as Mets GM was Brandon Nimmo, who has sort of run the gamut himself from a prospect who sort of raised eyebrows at the time when they made that pick to developing into a pretty reasonably decent prospect. He's hurt now, but going forward, they still like what they have there. And they've made their share of risky picks in the past. You know, one thing about the Mets and Sandy Alderson and Paul DePodesta, who heads up the draft, is they do not cave to public pressure at all with this stuff. They really do not, you know, sort of go with the grain in terms of what other teams, what scouts, what media, what sort of the popular perception is with these picks. They have their own scouts. They trust them fully, and you know, they're not afraid to reach for a guy if they think it's the best guy available. They're not afraid to take a guy in the second round, for example, who might have fell to the third or fourth if they hadn't picked him then. They like him a lot, and that goes for a lot of their picks. It's just it's a team that's very independent thinking with amateur scouting and that sort of thing, and you saw that a little bit in the draft.
You noted the very high number of pitchers they took. You know, baseball is not something, it's obviously not something like the NFL where you go in and you say, well, we need a cornerback and we need a left guard, and so we're going to take those for the first two picks. With that said, there can be guiding principles. So was the number of pitchers just the way it happened at each individual pick, or was that by design to some extent?
Well, I don't think it was just the way it happened. I mean, you can just look at Sandy Alderson's track record. He's built this thing, what the Mets are now, over the past 4 years. He has built it completely through pitching, and not just pitching, but pitching depth. At every turn, whenever he's had an opportunity to trade a pitcher, maybe help out an offense that has been consistently below average to bad under his tenure, he has refrained from doing so. The Mets are convinced, whereas a lot of teams these days say, you know, look at the high number of Tommy John surgeries and pitchers getting hurt in general and say, well, there's no such thing as a pitching prospect. We might as well trade these guys when they have value and so on and so forth. The Mets have really taken the opposite tack. And they're not the only team that says this, but their philosophy is really, no, we're going to hang on to every pitching prospect and we're going to amass every pitching prospect we possibly can, knowing that a huge number of them are not going to pan out. A huge number of them are going to get hurt, et cetera, et cetera. And the hope is that a small number of them make it through the ranks and make it to the big leagues and that's what we're seeing this season when the Mets have had more than their share of pitching injuries and they've been able to bring up a Noah Syndergaard or a Rafael Montero before he got hurt himself. And, you know, we're still looking down now and waiting to see when Steven Matz is going to come up. So that's sort of the Mets philosophy, and that starts 100% with the draft, drafting guys. And the other side of that also is one thing that Paul DePodesta noted was the Mets aren't necessarily a team that's done a lot in the international market in recent years, but what they have done has been almost exclusively position players. So a lot of those high upside guys in their minors, guys they've given reasonably big bonuses to, were hitters. So they wanted to supplement that a little bit more with pitching in the draft as well.
To switch to the 2015 club, for real, did they ditch the six-man because Terry Collins was tired of talking about it?
I mean, that's a very simple way to put it. I don't think tired of talking about it to the media necessarily, or tired of talking about it to his wife, as he joked at the time. But I do think he was definitely tired about having pitchers come into his office and say, what's the deal? I don't think when the Mets decided to go to a six-man, I don't think they envisioned as much backlash from their own staff as they did. And not that every Matt Harvey and Jacob DeGrom and so on and so forth was coming into the office and just saying what's going on and complaining constantly. But there was definitely a perception that the pitchers weren't pleased with this. Pitchers weren't necessarily trashing the idea on the record and things like that, but no one was going out of his way to support it. And I think, you know, at some point the Mets just sort of threw up their hands and said, you know what, while we still have to limit the innings of Harvey and DeGrom and Steven Matz when he comes up and Syndergaard, things happen over the course of the season. And maybe it'll become a problem later this summer. Possibly it won't. If other things come up, if a guy gets hurt, and so on and so forth. They have the personnel to make it work with a five-man. Dylan Jeek is the perfect guy to sort of serve in that swingman role and make some spot starts if needed. Once Rafael Montero gets healthy, he can do the same thing. Well, personally, and I've said this on this podcast before, I think the six-man was sort of the ideal in terms of being able to limit innings for pitchers and would have been a smoother way to do it. These are human beings too. And if you have six unhappy pitchers, it's not necessarily better than having five content pitchers and maybe one unhappy pitcher and doing things that way. So there was definitely, it definitely went beyond the X's and O's of baseball and how best to do this thing logistically. It definitely was more of a clubhouse culture type thing and keeping guys happy.
Was this really surprising? It's my understanding they at least discussed this some with at least some of these guys in advance. So they had to know, I presume they knew some of the reservations in advance. It really stands out to me. There are so many ways you could handle this. You say, well, we're going to slot somebody in one time and see how it goes and do that again, and suddenly you're there. But to announce, hey, we're doing this, and we're going to be doing this till August, and then say, nope, never mind, we're not. It raises some flags to me, so I guess the question I'm asking here, was it really that surprising? And if not, again, how did this go from we are doing this to no, never mind?
I mean, I think it's just sort of what I just said. There's a couple parts to it. I don't think management totally foresaw the unhappiness that was going to come out of this in the pitchers, and I don't think the pitchers maybe totally foresaw how much they were going to dislike their new routine. And you got to realize these are guys who are very much trained to take it day by day, to take it, never to look too far ahead, et cetera. And a couple of these guys went out that first time to the six-man rotation and had bad starts. And was that because of the six-man rotation? Probably not. But when you're looking at things through that narrow of a lens, I think, a couple of guys might have put two and two together and said, hey, maybe the six-man rotation isn't good for me. And then the complaints grow a little louder, the grumbling grows a little louder, and the Mets say, you know what, forget it. Let's just try and keep people happy, and we'll worry about later when it comes. If I was in management shoes, would I have just said, tough, this is how we're doing it, this is the best way? Maybe, but I don't have to deal with pitchers banging on my office door and saying I'm not happy. So, you know, it's easy to sit here and say this is a managerial goof or snafu or whatever it might be. But, you know, Terry Collins and his staff are the guys who have to deal with these pitchers every day. And, you know, if they think they made a mistake going to the six-man rotation and want to take it back to five, that's their prerogative. Now, it's just going to make things harder for them throughout the summer when they have to start limiting these innings. And it could make for an ugly situation if this team continues to compete and you have a Washington Nationals 2012 Steven Strasburg situation on your hands. The Mets do not want to be in that situation where they're just going to have to shut someone down. So they're going to have to get creative now. If they refuse to go to a six-man now, they're going to have to get creative throughout the rest of the summer.
Mark, we're going to talk some draft here, and I want to start with asking about Colby Allard, who the Braves seem to think, and I think they're not the only ones, might have gone even higher than he did if not for some health issues. So first of all, what is the prognosis on his health? How confident are they that they didn't get damaged goods?
Well, you're looking at a talented 17-year-old pitcher out of California who, you know, from what I understand, he did have a stress fracture in his back that it seems like he got it just swinging a bat too hard. I've heard home run derby, just messing around, batting practice type stuff. So he missed most of his senior season this year. I had a lot of success last year in international competition with Team USA. The guy that when they saw him throw his bullpen last year, scouting director Brian Bridges, he never imagined he'd be available with number 14. Now, Colby has been throwing for about 5 weeks right now, and that doesn't mean pitching. He's been throwing for 5 weeks, but from what I understand, and it makes sense to the timeline, once he signs and gets to camp, he will have basically no limitations moving forward. So he will have what you would call a regular schedule here for a first-year player. But, yeah, they do feel like they got, you know, like maybe some teams backed away because of the back. Braves feel like they took him in a real good spot there, number 14 overall.
What kind of upside are we talking about here? And we're talking about a guy who might have one upside or maybe not that high?
You know what? I guess I've heard, and maybe they're from the same area, Max Fried, who, you know, Paul Snyder, a veteran scout for the Braves, saw Max Fried long before Max Fried joined the Braves, saw him there in high school. I've heard some comparisons to him. I have not heard Paul Snyder specifically refer to Colby Allard as Max Fried, but when I hear Paul Snyder tell me about what he saw from Max Fried during his high school days, I see why everyone is so high on Fried. And there is a little bit there. Colby is a guy who he will go ahead and he's not your typical just soft-tossing lefty control type guy. He's got a little bit of giddy up on his fastball and a plus breaking ball there. So he's it will be interesting. You know, the part of that draft that's going to be great for him is that he's going to be able to spend the early days of his career with his high school teammate, Lucas Herbert, who the Braves drafted a catcher with their fourth selection on Monday night.
Yeah, it seems like on that first day, and that was a big day for them, seemed like they had took a lot of risk and a lot of upside. Did that just happen to be the guys that they liked at those points, or was that a philosophical decision?
I'll tell you what, we even go back to all these moves that they made throughout the winter. I don't know if there's a little bit of risk with Tyrell Jenkins, you know, with his injury past. You know, they go out and they get Max Fried, a guy coming off of Tommy John, and we've seen them, you know, they haven't been afraid to target those guys in the deal. And I see a pattern here where that extended into the draft with Allard, with the back issues, with A.J. Minter, they took with the 75th overall pick, the last pick on Monday. From what I understand, they would have been more than willing to probably take him at 28, which was their second selection that day, given his talent, big, strong left-hander out of Texas A&M. From what I hear, if he had not blown out his elbow and had Tommy John surgery in March, he might have had a chance to get into Atlanta's bullpen at some point this year. And, well, you know, as we've seen from the bullpen, that might have been tomorrow. But, you know, here's a guy who does have a lot of upside, but teams backed away from him, you know, because he is coming off Tommy John. That, you know, John Coppolella, John Hart, this regime, they have not seemed to shy away from those guys. They see them as, hey, look, we would never have a chance to get these guys in these specific spots, whether that's, you know, with Allard or Mentor. So why don't we go ahead and take a chance and just, you know, they kind of view it as one Tommy John with Mentor, that's no big deal. And just hope that that he gets back to where he was earlier this year, where they saw him have an overpowering fastball there during the early part of the season with Texas A&M.
The way the draft is structured, there's a certain amount of money allotted to each pick. There's a slotting system, and so theoretically, whether you have 20 picks in the first five rounds or three picks in the first five rounds, theoretically, you should be able to get them all signed at slot. In practicality, it doesn't often work that way, which is a very long preface to ask, is there any worry about being able to get all of these guys signed if they've got to go over slot for one and maybe under another? How do they, are these guys kind of all fit together as far as getting them all under contract and playing pro ball?
Well, you know, I'm just looking here the first few picks here, and I do think there are some guys that are going to be able to get under slot to be able to go over slot to maybe a couple others. Michael Soroka, their second pick. Maybe he wasn't, they take him 28th overall. I don't think a lot of teams had him that high on their board. Maybe my expectation or anticipation is that we will hear that maybe he signs slightly under slot, and then all of a sudden, whether a little bit more of that money is given to Colby Allard or to Mentor, you know, we'll find out when these deals are done. But one thing Brian Bridges did tell us, the scouting director, is basically all of these first, I believe he said 6-7, we're done. That was as of recently, or as I think that was Tuesday or Wednesday. I forget exactly which day, but he, you know, hey, look, they're not signed, but verbally, everything's been taken care of from that financial end. But yeah, I do think that we will see some guys under slot, and maybe even later in that those first 10 picks. They took some chances on some guys that really weren't you know, projected to go nearly as high. You know, Ryan Clark from UNC Greensboro, Matt Withrow from Texas Tech, Patrick Weigel from Houston, all college arms that they maybe, you know, project long-term to be relievers. They're not guys that they're going to rush to double A or anything like that. They don't have that kind of upside that Mentor would have had he been healthy. But I do see that maybe you have some wiggle room there to be able to take care of your higher selections.
One idea we heard a lot when the Braves made their front office changes, and to their credit, not so much from the club, that they weren't hanging on this, but it was an idea that was commonly expressed, and I think everybody who was looking could kind of see it, was this idea of getting back to the old Braves, to do things with this scouting development-based model the way they used to do it, to build the organization the way it was built for that amazing run in the 90s. Are there things about this draft that they did that show you evidence of that? Are there ways that this draft looks maybe any more like the way they used to draft than recent years, or is there not that kind of stark black and white difference?
Yeah, I do see some similarities. I saw, in terms of pitching heavy, they went 12 of their first 14 selections this year were pitchers. There were 3 years where I can draw a comparison, 2000, 2003 and 2006. Roy Clark is the special assistant to the general manager. He came back this year, or in September, I should say, or right as the new regime took over. He came in. Brian Bridges is the scouting director. Brian trained under Roy. That's, you know, that's his mentor. This draft looked a whole lot like a Roy Clark draft, minus the inclusion of a lot of local talent. You know, we didn't see a local guy taken until they took Ryan Lawler there in the eighth round, a left-hander out of the University of Georgia. That's really the only element. But Roy Clark has always, you know, been a guy who's pitching heavy. I talked to John Hart the other day, and I threw out a number. I said, you know, sometimes you need 15 pitchers to find three of them that are going to be, you know, effective at the big league level. He said, hey, look, I subscribe to the 2-10 theory. Or basically, you need to put 10 prospects out there, and maybe you're going to find two. But you get the kind of the sense of what I'm saying is, you know, it's nice to talk about all these guys, to be optimistic that they're all going to make it. But at the end of the day, you're going to step back and realize that back in 2000, Adam Wainwright proved to be the first one that they took. He proved to be one of the few real effective arms that they took. In 2003, they took all those pitchers. There were only a couple that panned out. 2006, I'm trying to think who that was. In 2008, let's go to 2008, they had four or five guys. They didn't take as many pitchers there early. Wasn't that 12 out of 14? But they ended up taking four or five pitchers, and some of them were Zeke Sproul, Paul Clemens, a lot of guys that they've ended up trading these pieces. And I think that's where the value in pitching is. Not only, you know, maybe you'll find a gem that's going to help you, your own staff, but at the same time, there's always such a great value placed on pitching from other teams. It's nice to be able to deal from an area of strength. And if you're going to have strength in numbers, so that the more pitching you have, you know, might allow you to make deals like you did for Zeke Sproul when you included him in the Justin Upton deal. The Clemens and Brett Oberholzer were from that same draft. They were used to get Michael Bourne. So, you know, these guys, you're not going to see all these guys in Atlanta. I mean, no one's ever going to say that, but, you hope enough of them develop that where you have the depth to where you can either, you know, find value from them on the field directly or somewhat indirectly via trades.
Joe, conventional wisdom, the general reaction suggested that the Marlins reached a little bit when they drafted Josh Naylor in the first round. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, they definitely reached. You know, the question is how much, you know. Here's a guy, I think with MLB.com had him 59th, and other services had him like 60, 61 in that neighborhood. An interesting one because, you know, Matthew, I think this year also with 12, you know, with their top 10 picks and no compensatory picks or anything else, which in recent years they had more of, you know, maybe they would have rolled the dice on a Brady Aiken at 12, knowing that they had higher picks. I think they tried to be as safe as possible and also spread the money. So, you know, they got a kid with immense power in Josh Naylor. I mean, everything you hear, you know, the Prince Fielder comps in terms of bat speed and pure power, kid's just 17. He's not turning 18 till later this month. You know, if he hits, you know, and becomes what they think he can, then, you know, it'll be a good return. But there are doubts, and, you know, that's the thing about the baseball draft is not an exact science, but if they feel they, you know, kind of can move some money and get like their sixth round pick, the catcher, Justin Cohen, I believe his name, from Sarasota, and convince him not to go to FSU and a few other picks, you know, in that 6-12 range, you know, then I think they feel that, you know, they kind of maximize the draft as best they could.
The one tool, as you note, is obvious, but what made them feel like they couldn't pass on this guy this high with the notion that maybe they could have gotten him around later? Beyond just the simple
just
fact that he's got power, what made them think we have to do this now?
Well, I think there was a conviction, too, from, you know, some in the room that this guy, the power just was so obvious, and while they'll, you know, neglect, you know, there was some consent and hoping to get like a Whitley who went one pick later, an outfielder with McCutcheon type comps. And yeah, so it, you know, there was just a strong opinion that he wasn't going to be there when they picked at 50. So, you know, they kind of moved. And he even saw, I think Jonathan Mayo in the blog noted that even the Cubs and I think he said the Red Sox, you know, had interest as well. So I guess they're kind of thought that, you know, if they spun it over into the 40, you know, the picks 35 to 40 in that range, he would be gone, and then they would be left without the bat that they thought was the most impactful in terms of just driving the baseball out of the ballpark.
Now, one guy that they might have gotten a deal on, so to speak, Brett Lillick fell a little this year. He was a guy that was regarded pretty highly coming into the year and a little less so at the end of the year. What's their read on him? Do they feel like he's maybe a legit first-round talent?
Yeah, they do. They think, you know, he's an advanced, you know, left-hander from from a major conference, major school in Arizona State. A year ago they took Trevor Williams out of Arizona State, a right-hander, hard thrower who was a teammate of Brett. So, you know, they're, you know, have familiarity with him for a while. They thought that the biceps tendonitis that, you know, was scared some people away. But, you know, they thought this was first round talent in the second round. Now, you know, what you tend to see, Matthew, you know, their logic and their strategy every year is go heavy on pitching. But here's a guy with what worries me a little bit about Brett is the command. You know, it's a guy, the command was off. So if that's a mechanical thing and easy to fix, but, you know, then, okay, you know, then you got something. But, you know, if he's going to be another guy that, you know, they took Brad Hand several years ago in the second round and command continues to be his issue, you know, left-hander with really good arm, but, you know, if you're going to be pitching behind the count a lot, you know, that's not a good thing. So, you know, I think they thought that, you know, going with Naylor in first round and Brett Lillick in the second round, they got, you know, power bat, the power, you know, or lefty, at least, you know, mid-90s, and they feel they addressed it to needs in both areas.
Is there anything you can glean or deduce sort of broadly, philosophically, strategically about their draft as a whole? Is there anything that tells you about them as an organization?
Yeah, Matthew, this one, you know, just in talking to people I respect and just kind of getting trying to get as objective a read as possible, this was an average draft, you know, overall. That was kind of the consensus. And basically the Marlins did average in an average draft. And, you know, they're going to need some of these projects to hit. But, you know, they, you know, without big pool money to spend and without that conviction of saying, man, this is a guy, this is a Jose Fernandez type, you know, and you know, we could invest a little bit there and then move forward. You know, they just kind of felt, we'll just play it safe. And, you know, and they look, you know, the early rounds, the projections are there. You know, the third round pick, they took higher than, you know, where he was listed as well. And Isaiah White, the speedster, who they thought matchups, you know, similarly to Garrett Whitley, who went 13. So organizationally, they didn't, you know, spend their top dollars. They didn't have top dollars, and they just kind of played it safe and got, you know, took guys with some ceiling. And from what I heard, there are going to be guys on this draft that are going to play in the pros and be pretty good players. So, you know, we'll see how it turns out. I don't know if they'll get a start. If, you know, if Naylor hits as they hope, you know, then they got a steal there. But as of now, the word average is what kind of, you know, jumps out at me about this draft and the Marlins' end of this draft.
So to switch to the big league roster, let's do a segment we've been doing for weeks now, the injured starting pitchers. What's the latest on Jared Cosart, on Henderson Alvarez, on Jose Fernandez? How close are those guys to getting back?
Well, first and foremost, Latos is going to be back and starting on Saturday. So, you know, he's back in, so that's a relief. Jared Cosart threw, I think it was 5 2/3 innings, like 95 or 98 pitches last night for New Orleans, gave up two runs, struck out, I think, only one, but didn't walk anyone, which is probably a good thing, but didn't get the strikeouts. But Jared's a fastball guy, and from running a stand team he played, there's a fastball hitting team. So, you know, he's going to be a guy who I think is probably going to get ready to join sometime next week. But it may take him a couple of starts to kind of find his flow and get going. Jose still tracking in that July 1st range, you know, 1st to 7th, anytime in there is when I expect to see him. And Henderson Alvarez, I'm kind of thinking August, you know, at the earliest with him, only because, you know, there's a lot of concern about, you know, he came back probably quicker than he should have. And even though there's no surgery being involved in this, you know, kind of that dead arm and building it up, I think it's just going to take a while.
We've talked a ton about the rotation. It's understandable. They're doing without a big part of what was expected to be the strength of the team. But even so, I think you could accurately say the pitching for this team has been passable. It's been fine. It hasn't been terrible.
Yeah. Starting pitching.
Yeah.
Starting pitching.
Yeah, that's a fine point. Fine point.
Yeah.
The outfield, however, which was expected to be the other real strength of the team, has really disappointed. And I think if you were being fair, you could even throw Stanton in there a little bit. He's hit for a ton of power, but he's hitting 249. What do you see with those guys who are really supposed to be the engine of this offense?
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I think Yelich, you know, in the last couple of days, just looking at him move around the field, he looks like he's moving around better. We know he had the back injury in the first month of the season. He just wasn't moving well. I mean, he's got plus speed and just kind of glides. And last night made a really good catch, looking like the Yelich of old. So, they're kind of hoping that, my observation is, although he won't admit, I think that he's now feeling healthy. So, the Christian Yelich that they expect should start to surface. Ozuna, the power is just not there at home. And on the road, he's got four home runs. The batting average is decent. And he's got a little bit of he's got this hitting streak going. But they need home runs from this guy. And, I think Marlins Park has frustrated him a bit, as it does every offensive player in this team. And, but clearly those three are the nucleus. And if they're going to go with Yelich 3, Stanton 4, and Ozuna 5, there they are. That's what they thought was the best outfield in the National League, if not the big leagues. So they've got them all lined up now, and, now is going to be kind of a time to shine for them. But, I think Ozuna got caught with maybe trying to do too much. And I'll be, just kind of a little bit of knock on him, too. There was questions about his conditioning coming into the season. Was he a little bit overweight? He's obviously not your prototypical body type guy in center field. And, he does cover ground and do some good things in the outfield, no question. But, he's kind of a streaky guy. And, if he's, playing at a weight that they're real comfortable with, he's a high impact guy. So, they're going to clearly need them. And then Stanton, just the strikeouts, Matthew, and it's, like even last night, he had it's kind of hard to knock a guy with four RBIs, but you'd like to see when he had first and third and less than two outs, not strike out on three pitches with it was a good, I think it was a fastball off the plate and then by a hard thrower. He just expands. He just expands the zone now with two strikes instead of, that's why I always think Stanton's at his best when he's walking, because that means he's taking that breaking ball or pitch right off the outside, better. So, I'd like to see, we'd like to see this guy, get that batting average up and get, those RBI hits from time to time, not just, mash and, be fun on StatCast every night.
He hit 288 last year at age 24, and I think it was reasonable to expect that was sort of maybe the beginning of his coming into his own as not just a power guy. I certainly don't want to put limits on a guy with just staggering talent, but is it maybe that his true level is a 260, 270 kind of hitter who some years is going to hit more than that and some years is going to hit less than that? Maybe he's just not, and again, that's fine. The point is not that this guy is flawed, but maybe he's just not going to turn into that 290, 300 hitter that he's shown flashes of?
Yeah. To me, Matthew, that's going to come down to just where his head's at psychologically, because he was last year and even, the hit in the face and what impact that had. Because, he was always kind of a lunger. Now he backs off. And that's why you so regularly see first pitch fastball inside, second pitch slider or something hard away. Just trying to move his feet, get him not comfortable in there. I don't know. It's going to be real interesting to see, because I do believe this guy is 280 to 300. And, clearly, the power is going to make him MVP and an all-star anyway. But the batting average and, then that just elevates everything else, makes him best player in the game. So I see that in him. And, I think, and knowing this guy, and he cares a lot, and he gets kind of moody. I don't mean that in a bad way, but he tries to do too much. If he senses the offense is doing nothing, then he will chase. So I think, if Yelich and Ozuna and the rest of the offense clicks the way they think, then I think you're going to see a more relaxed Stanton, rather than, you know, we're getting only two runs tonight, and if I don't hit a two-run homer right now, you know, that's going to be it. You know, that kind of gets into that mindset. So the less he's in that mindset, the more he's in a comfortable, let me just get up there and let my ability take over and, you know, use the strike zone in my favor and you know, build this. Yeah, then I think you're looking at the MVP, Stanton.
Todd, I always get a kick out of comps on draft day because some of them make a lot of sense and some of them are really silly. And sometimes you get a guy like Cornelius Randolph where the names that get thrown about, it's almost like the who are three people who have never been in my kitchen. Dimitri Young, Tony Gwynn, Robinson Cano. The only thing I can put together out of those three guys is that they all have, they weren't just good hitters, they had an elite hit tool. Is that really the key? I mean, we heard about this guy as an offensive player, but is the real key not just power, that he's got that potentially elite hit tool?
Yes, I absolutely think that that's the case with him. You know, talking to Johnny Almaraz, their new amateur scouting director, before the draft, we talked to him about how the organization really doesn't have any power in it, and wouldn't you like to have power? And he says, you know, I like hitters, guys that can actually hit the baseball, and in some cases the power will come, but I like pure hitters. And they see that in Randolph. They, you know, a lot of people said he was one of the best, if not the best, high school hitter in the draft. But they also think that this is a guy who will hit for power at some point. So I think I wrote this the other day. If he comes anywhere near those three guys, they will be beyond over the moon thrilled with their pick. I mean, we're talking about three elite hitters over an extended period of time, certainly with Gwynn and Robinson Cano, but they seem pretty thrilled that they have this guy with the 10th overall pick.
Now, the other thing that jumps out, and again, I don't want to make too much of names that people are throwing on a guy when he's 18. I remember the names that were attached to Pete Cosma, and there were things like it was Derek Jeter and Skip Schumacher. So, you know, I don't want to make too much of it. But the other thing that does raise a little bit of a yellow flag is that, with the exception of Cano, those are not exactly good body guys.
Right.
Is there some concern? You already wrote Randolph is likely to play on the outfield, but is there some concern about how he develops physically? Is he likely to be? Is there any worry about him kind of not being a good body guy?
You know, honestly, Matthew, I haven't heard too much of that. I think, you know, the fact that, you know, granted, he's a high school shortstop, and you know, most of your best players play shortstop in high school, but they think he's athletic enough that it won't be an issue, but certainly he's not athletic enough to play shortstop in everyday basis. Immediately in that press conference, one of the first things Johnny Almaraz said was he's going to move to left field. So, you know, is that a concern? Perhaps. But I'll be honest, I think the Phillies look at it and say, you know what, if this guy hits and he can put up numbers close to, you know, whatever, look at Dimitri Young's numbers over a 10-year span. If he can put up those numbers, I think with the way the game is going right now, where it's so tough to find hitters, that they would happily take that.
Yeah, and you set me up for something else I wanted to ask about, because I think there's an interesting question here. There's this, the sort of conventional wisdom is there's no power in the game, everybody needs power. But there really is power. When you know, power on contact is kind of the same as it's ever been. What is hard to find is singles, is base hits. Do you think, beyond that being just a personal philosophy, do you think that the sort of context of the game today, the offensive shape of the game today, magnifies the need for guys who can just get base hits?
I think so, and I think that's exactly what the Phillies tried to do in this draft. 13 of their first 18 picks were position players, and they think that all these guys have potential to hit. You know, I think it was the 14th round pick, Austin Bozarty, the catcher out of Penn. Johnny Almaraz said something interesting. I thought, you know, he said, look at big league catchers right now. Big league catchers, on average, are hitting .233. If Austin Bozart can hit .240, .250, we consider ourselves, you know, we consider that a win for us, you know, at the big league level. So, you know, they really went hard with the hitters early. And his philosophy is, you know, you can draft a lot of college pitchers in that 18 to 28, 30 round range. that can throw in the low 90s that might be able to pick it up a notch, or, and if not, could still be effective relief pitchers, maybe even a starting pitcher. So kind of a new philosophy, a different philosophy for the Phillies. Load up on hitters early and go with those college pitchers late, believing that pitching right now is easier to find, and they just want to like load that organization right now with exactly what you said, just guys that can get base hits, guys can hit some balls in the gap, not necessarily hit home runs, but you just need guys that can get on base and score some runs.
And you kind of set me up again for my next. What a pro you are for my next question, which is what sort of philosophical differences did you see broadly in this draft under the new regime, not a new general manager, but a new scouting director, as they, and really a pivotal draft. What did you sort of see broadly philosophically from them this time around?
Yeah, well, we just talked about, they went hitters high, and then they went, I think it was 10 consecutive pitchers between rounds 18 to 27 or something like that. But a couple other things. We heard a lot less of, this guy's an athlete with high ceiling. Now, we heard guys being athletic and high ceiling, but here's the difference, what I'm trying to say, is it was a lot of, this guy knows how to play baseball. He's a baseball player with a high ceiling, not so much he's an athlete with a high ceiling. Johnny Almaraz made a point to say he wants to draft guys that play the game, know how to play the game, have instincts for the game, rather than going like, this guy's an unbelievable athlete. If we can just tap into that athletic talent, hey, this guy played football, this guy was on the track team, this guy also played baseball, he's just a great athlete. If we can just tap into that, we might have something. No, he wanted baseball players with high ceilings. So he talked a lot about that before the draft and then during the draft. And another thing that I thought was interesting, I was just finishing up with my interview with him the other day, and just kind of out of nowhere, he goes, another thing about these guys is they all have really good numbers. And I said, well, yeah, of course, high school kids always have great numbers. You're not getting drafted if you don't get great numbers. But then he kind of added, he said, Scott Friedman and our analytics team really played a big role in helping us kind of narrow guys down. And I'd never really heard that before. So they really seem to take analytics into the draft as much as possible. And he said, he's like, listen, I'm as old school as anybody, but I really think that this is an important part of the game. So any little extra bit of information can help us. And really the Phillies have been criticized a lot for not taking analytics seriously enough. So I thought that was kind of refreshing to hear him say that.
Yeah. Now we can actually talk a little bit about the 2015 Phillies, though, as usual, we may be talking about guys who may not continue to be 2015 Phillies. It seems like there's a new round of Jonathan Papelbon rumors swirling. And as we've discussed, he seems like the one guy who might not necessarily wait until July 31st. Where does that stand? Do you get the feeling that there might be some momentum building towards him going somewhere?
I think there's definitely some momentum building. There's a lot more interest. The Blue Jays and Cubs have been reported as being interested teams, and they are interested teams. I think, again, though, it comes down to the Phillies have come this far. They're willing to gamble that Jonathan Papelbon stays healthy and pitches effectively up until July 31st. So in their mind, while their talks are heating up with the Blue Jays and the Cubs, they haven't gotten that prospect or prospects back that they just feel like they're going to give up for Jonathan Papelbon. So I think they're really holding to their guns. Whether or not that comes back to bite them remains to be seen. But at this moment, I think their thinking is, we can still trade him a month from now. And a month from now, a couple of these teams might be a little bit more desperate. The lead, maybe their division lead or wild card lead might be shrinking a little bit. Maybe there's a couple more blown saves here or there. And they might go, all right, let's make this happen. Because I think two things that the Phillies are thinking about is, one is the Cliff Lee trade to the Mariners in December 2009. They can't have a repeat of that. And basically they don't want to give up on these guys too early. Like I said, they've come this far, and they feel that, they can wait another month to get what they want, and time will tell. They're willing to eat money to trade Papelbon to get the prospects back, so it's not a money dump situation either.
And then one last thing. There was some speculation, and I just wanted to ask you, because it kind of makes sense, but it also kind of doesn't, that some of the little moves the Phillies have made recently, for example, bringing in Kevin Correa, a couple of the minor league free agent signings that they've made to bring bodies in, there's been some speculation that maybe that's sort of preparing them to trade some guys just so they have warm bodies if they do make trades. Do you think that's a decent connection to draw, or are those kind of unrelated?
Yeah, I think they're related somewhat. I don't think it's the completely the reason, like, you know, this is imminent, we've got to get some guys in here because something's going to happen. But I definitely think that that's kind of in the back of their mind. They need depth in the system overall. I think, you know, Gutierrez, who signed over from who opted out of his contract with the Giants, signed with the Phillies, he's in AAA. I think he sees more of an opportunity to make the big leagues here. But certainly, once these guys are traded, they're going to need people. Now, if they trade, say, Cole Hamels and Aaron Harang, it would not surprise me if Aaron Nola is one of those guys called up. But, you know, they still might need another arm somewhere. So I think, and same thing with the bullpen, they need some people to fill some holes. So, yeah, I think that is related, but I don't think it's the only reason why they're doing it, in the sense that it's not like, uh-oh, we're like days away from trading all these guys. We better get some people in here fast.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.